Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
Just like you had your hair in that room with those three dead people in that location, right?
No, man.
Your hair in the bed next to the bat you used to kill Amy and Sava Savopoulos. Isn't that right?
No, man.
I know Judy well enough to know that she takes her job so seriously that she would have had a very long conversation and told him the positives and the negatives about testifying.
You know that Durrell went, took the police to a location in that block and pointed out a pile of burned debris in that area. Is that right?
No, ma'am.
You didn't know it was coming directly from your brother?
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare. After hearing Darren Wint testify in his own murder trial, you may be wondering how police tracked him down. His arrest is one of the most dramatic parts of this case. But to set it up, we actually have to go back to the night before, when the world first learned Darren Wint's name.
A suspect has been identified in the murders of three family members and their housekeeper in Northwest D.C. WTOP's Michelle Bash joins us live with details.
Yes, we're just getting this in from D.C. police tonight, and police are hoping you can help them find this suspect in connection with last week's murders.
On the night of May 20th, 6 days after first responders rushed to the Savopoulos' burning house and made the horrible discovery inside, D.C. police revealed the name of their suspect. This is a WTOP report from that night.
The suspect's name is 34-year-old Darren Dylan Wint. He's wanted for the murders that took place on Woodland Drive Northwest in the 3200 block last Thursday. He's described as a black male, 5'7 in height, weighing about 155 pounds. Again, his name is 34-year-old Darren Dylan Wint.
Reporters packed into a room at D.C. Police headquarters the next morning, hoping to learn more information about the man police said was responsible.
We do believe that there is a connection between this suspect in this case through the business. So right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime, but there is a connection through the business.
That's then D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier at a press conference on May 21st, 2015. She was referring to Darren Wint's connection to Sava's business, American Ironworks, where Darren worked 10 years earlier. Behind the chief during her press conference stood two blown-up pictures of Darren Wint, pulled from his Facebook page. In one photo, Darren looks serious. His long dreadlocks hanging over his chest. He's wearing jeans and a white T-shirt, and a large silver cross hangs from his neck. He's holding a cigarette down by his thigh. The other photo is different. Darren has a wide smile. He's leaning on someone who has been cropped out of the picture, but it's clear Darren has his arm around them. In that photo, Darren's wearing a blue tracksuit with a baseball cap on backwards. The night before that news conference, police raided the home of Darren's dad and stepmom in Lanham, Maryland, where Darren was living at the time, but Darren wasn't there. After searching the house and talking to Darren's family, police had a better idea of where to find him.
Information gained from interviews and new information in the past few hours, we believe Mr. Wint is currently in the Brooklyn, New York area. The task force is continuing to search for Mr. Wint. I have been in contact with the commissioner from the NYPD. They have offered and are providing all assistance that we need in trying to locate Mr. Wendt.
From obscurity to one of the most wanted men in America, Darren Wendt was now a fugitive. And that news conference triggered a nationwide manhunt.
But now that puts you on alert for someone like myself. You coming into the newsroom, it's like, you know, you just know. You're on the lookout for every arrest. You're on the lookout for police lights because you just don't know where it's going to come.
Later that night, May 21st, 2015, Washington Post reporter Clarence Williams was working his regular night shift when he got a call in the newsroom. After 20 years of working the beat, he says there's usually a lot of waiting around. But this call was urgent. It was from one of his sources about a possible arrest in Northeast D.C., something involving that guy everyone was looking for.
And it's one of those that you go out of an abundance of caution.
Clarence said he couldn't risk missing what could be the takedown and arrest of Darren Wendt. But it had only been a day since police officially identified their suspect.
That idea of him suddenly being back in D.C. that fast, you know, was stunning, frankly. You know, and it just, you went from zero to 60 because I really thought he wasn't in the area.
When Clarence arrived in Northeast D.C., the quiet neighborhood was already pulsing with red and blue police lights.
You know, it was dark. It was before midnight, kind of in that 11:30-ish hour that I got out there. And, you know, this stretch of Rhode Island Avenue is, it's really busy during the day, but at night it's virtually deserted.
It was clear to Clarence something big had happened. Behind the yellow tape, in the middle of the street, was a large box truck. Several feet behind that was a white sedan. All of the car doors were open, and the trunk was popped. But Clarence was stuck behind the perimeter, unable to cross the tape and get a better look.
I've got some really thick glasses that I've been wearing since I was 4 years old, and I'm nearly 50 now. So it's a lot of squinting your eyes and trying to see every little detail you can from a block away. And, you know, and what's the make of that car? Is that a Chevy? Is that... And there's the light's bad, so is it white? Is it silver?
It was also clear to Clarence that whoever had been in those vehicles had already been carted away by police.
Again, with most things in this case, a lot of questions. What is going on? Who was where? Where was he sitting? Who was he with? Who was he traveling with? Why are they traveling with a truck, of all things? And what's inside the truck?
And the most important question.
Is the suspect in custody? Is Darren Wendt identified?
Standing on the dim street corner, Clarence took out his phone and began working his sources in law enforcement. Eventually, he got D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier on the line. She said the three words Clarence needed to run with the story. Just got him.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wendt, stretching all the way to New York City, ended in the district. The 34-year-old was arrested in Northeast.
The Washington Post reports Wendt was traveling with two women in a white Chevrolet Cruze. The other vehicle was a box truck with two men inside. Police pinned the vehicles at Rhode Island Avenue and 10th Street Northeast. They arrested Wendt and took the others into custody. At least $10,000 were found in the truck.
The Washington Post had already broken the news that $40,000 had been delivered to the Savopoulos home while the victims were being held captive. Was the money in the vehicles connected to the ransom?
And we just didn't know. We knew it was a large amount. We just didn't know specifically and whether it would match up to what, you know, potentially could have happened inside the house.
Cash wasn't the only thing investigators found. They also found money orders in both vehicles. The search warrants filled out by officers on the scene also noted that inside the Chevy Cruze, there was a black and pink drawstring bag, clothing, and cell phones of the people riding inside. On the floor of the box truck, they found a crumpled up yellow piece of paper with an address, a phone number, and the word detective written on it. These little details didn't make it into anyone's reporting that night. Every story was about the dramatic arrest, which turned out to be far more complicated than U.S. Marshals had planned.
I'm Jamie Forzato in College Park, Maryland, where local police and federal marshals tracked Darren Wendt to this Howard Johnson Hotel off of Route 1.
It was a very fluid situation. We were planning on figuring out where he was in the hotel and then taking him down. When we were approaching, we realized he was in a vehicle.
Robert Fernandez, the commander of the Capital Area Regional Fugitive Task Force, says they followed two vehicles into the district.
That's a WTOP report from the motel. The arrest made national news following a week of coverage of the murders and the manhunt for Darren Wendt.
We try and draw a picture of relatives, locations where he's lived, friends, patterns of life.
ABC's 2020 spoke with the same commander, Robert Fernandez, about tracking Darren Wint to the Howard Johnson.
The U.S. Marshals advance team notices Wint leaving the hotel, but he isn't alone.
That advance team radioed to us. They had a suspicion that he was in one of two vehicles that were right over here.
In one of those vehicles, Wint and three women. In the other, Wint's younger brother, Darrell, and their cousin.
At that moment, both of those vehicles left and turned northbound.
Didn't see that coming.
Not at all. But we're ready to roll with it.
The U.S. Marshals began to follow the group. Traveling in a caravan, the box truck with North Carolina tags was followed by a white Chevy Cruze. They followed them for about 25 minutes, from the motel in Maryland over the D.C. line. As the caravan approached a red light, the U.S. Marshals deployed what Fernandez called a vehicle pin-blocking maneuver. Law enforcement vehicles surrounded the box truck and the sedan on all sides, and on the commander's go, the police car in front of the caravan reversed. The back car sped up, and four others surrounded the truck and the sedan on their sides, pinning them in.
In the rear passenger seat of the white Chevy, Darren Wint, trapped.
He followed commands. He got out. He crawled. He got on the ground. He was immediately handcuffed and brought over to a police vehicle, and he didn't say a word.
What did you see?
In the truck, I saw in the side compartment of the passenger door, a big wad of cash, and it was $100 bills. You could tell it was hundreds.
Word quickly got out that Darren Wint's brother, Darrell, was one of the two men riding in the box truck. But who were these other people traveling with a known fugitive? Clarence Williams says he remembers dozens of questions swirling in his mind about what he'd just learned.
Probably the biggest mystery of all was, what was this truck about? You know, who travels in tandem with a large white truck, and you wonder, is it stacked with cash? And this wasn't a small van. This wasn't a pickup truck. This was the size of what you'd rent from U-Haul, you know, or one of the storage, you know, to move a small apartment. So what was in it? And that was, you're standing there and just wondering.
The fact that Darren was arrested with five other people seemed to give weight to the theory that several assailants took part in the crime. But after hours of questioning on the night of the arrest, every one of the five people detained with Darren Wint, including his brother Darrell, was let go. At the time, we didn't know who they were or what their role was, and we wouldn't know for years. Why Darren was with those people and why they were headed toward downtown D.C. the night he was arrested, that remained a mystery. As for Darren, he stayed behind bars, awaiting trial for years, and as far as we know, he reserved his right to remain silent. Once the arrest was over and Darren Wint was in custody for the brutal killings of Sava, Amy, Philip Savopoulos, and Vera Figueroa, the national spotlight on the so-called Manson murders dimmed, and information on the case went silent. Getting answers to what seemed like basic questions about the night Darren was arrested, getting any information about the case itself, seemed like piercing an impenetrable wall, even for seasoned reporters like Clarence Williams.
I had more than one conversation, either with sources or, you know, with colleagues, where I'd wondered, like, what else do they have? Do they have enough? Why is this taking so long? What else are we going to hear, and when are we going to hear?
3 years later, on the first day of his murder trial, the silence around this case was broken when his lawyers stood up inside courtroom 203 of D.C. Superior Court and proclaimed Darren's innocence, pointing the finger at his two younger brothers, Stefan and Darrell. Prosecutors Laura Bach and Chris Bruckman scoffed at the defense's allegations the crime was committed by Darren's brothers. They said Stefan and Darrell Wint had nothing to do with the horrible crime on Woodland Drive, and that Darren was trying to get away with murder. But because the defense built its case around the possibility of their involvement, the prosecution was basically forced into the role of defending Darrell and Stefan. They had to show the jurors Darren's story was a desperate lie and that his two brothers were innocent. To do that, they'd have to tell the full story of what happened the night Darren Wint was arrested. And to do that, they'd end up calling brother to testify against brother.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Darren's brother, Stefan Wendt, took the stand on October 2nd. We called him multiple times to see if he wanted to tell his side of the story and be part of this podcast. And each time we spoke to him, he turned us down. He didn't have anything to add. He said he didn't want to be part of this madness. But his testimony during the trial fills in his part of the story. Stefan was not there the night Darren was arrested. He said he saw his brother's arrest on the news, just like everybody else. When Stefan testified, which was actually a few weeks before Darren took the stand, we learned the two hadn't always gotten along. Family members testified their personalities were always very different. In a way, Darren and Stefan seemed like a study in contrasts. Where Darren is brawny and average height, Stefan is tall and lanky. When he took the stand, Stefan wore khakis, a button-down shirt, and a sweater vest. Earlier, when their stepmother was asked in court to describe Stefan, she used the word geeky. Like Urkel, she said. And honestly, it seemed like a pretty accurate description. Stefan started his testimony with his backstory. He came from Guyana to the U.S. with Darren back in 2000. Stefan was 18 then, 1 year younger than Darren. 15 years later, at the time of the murders, Stefan was working for a construction company called PCM Services, which is based in Beltsville, Maryland. He'd worked for the company since he immigrated and settled in Maryland. By the spring of 2015, Stefan was a supervisor in the painting division. Over the years, as Stefan rose through the ranks at PCM, he tried helping his brother out. Around 2006 or 2007, he testified he'd hired Darren to be his helper, but it didn't work out. And ultimately, Darren had to be let go. Still, Stefan said, he continued to help Darren. He offered him a place to stay after Darren got kicked out of their sister Samantha's place. And in the spring of 2015, Stefan said, yes, he'd offered Darren a painting job, but it had nothing to do with going to a mansion in Northwest DC. In fact, Stefan was in charge of a big project at George Washington University. The university had contracted with PCM to give its DC dorms a fresh coat of paint over the summer. It was a big job, and Stefan needed all the help he could get. He said he reached out to a bunch of guys who might be interested, several relatives, cousins, as well as his brothers, Darren and Darrell. Stefan said he wasn't sure of the exact date when he called Darren about the painting job, but he never got in touch with him. However, Stefan was able to reach Darrell, his younger half-brother. Darrell, it turned out, was in between jobs and took Stefan up on his offer. When he testified, Stefan talked about when he first learned Darren's attorneys were accusing him of murder. No one gave him a heads up. He saw that on the local news, too. It was a report from the start of Darren's murder trial when Stefan learned that some of the DNA evidence linking Darren to the crime also matched his DNA. You might remember from our episode on the five things, a tiny hair was among the forensic evidence investigators discovered in the bloody bedding in the upstairs bedroom where the adults were found. Investigators said that hair matched Darren Wendt, but mitochondrial DNA is shared by siblings who have the same mother, like Darren and Stefan. The only way to say for certain which brother the hair belonged to was if the root were still attached, which it wasn't. As far as hard physical evidence that implicated Stefan, that was it. Prosecutors made a point to say, while Stefan had the same mitochondrial DNA profile as Darren, so did their mom, and that didn't make her a suspect in the murders. But Darren Wendt's lawyers had more. They also tried to cast suspicion on Stefan's actions and whereabouts during the murders. On May 13th and 14th of 2015, Stefan was working. managing several projects for PCM, including that dorm painting project. To help bolster his alibi, prosecutors pulled his timesheets for that week. On the 13th, the day the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were taken hostage, Stefan's timesheet showed he was at work from 6:30 a.m. until 4:30 p.m. The following day, when the family was killed and the Savopoulos home set on fire, Stefan was working even longer hours, from 6 a.m. until midnight. Stefan explained his 17-hour workday. He was overseeing a job that ran late, and he was required to stay until it was finished. When it was her turn to cross-examine Stefan, Judy Pipe was stinging and hostile in her questioning. Remember, he was a prosecution witness, and this was her chance to question the man she'd spent a month telling the jury was actually responsible for the murders. So first, about those timesheets. She was incredulous that he could have really been working that whole time. And another thing, they were all handwritten. As far as supporting an alibi, in her words, they were worthless. Stefan responded that while his timesheets were handwritten, his supervisors at PCM could confirm their accuracy. The company tracks the GPS on his work truck, so they could show his white pickup was at work sites when he said he was there. Judy Pipe seized on that detail. A white truck? Did you know, she asked Stefan, that a witness reported seeing a white pickup truck leaving the area in Prince George's County when Darren's blue minivan was set on fire? No, Stefan said. Then Judy Pipe changed tack again. You borrowed Darren Wint's van, didn't you? She asked. Stefan seemed a bit exasperated. Why would I borrow a van if I have a pickup truck? He asked. Because you didn't want it traced back to you, Judy Pipe shot back. Another big part of Judy's cross-examination, let's call it the George Washington University connection. Seems a little long, but it works. The spot where Darren's van was parked on May 14th, 24th and K Streets, is near the school's campus. Now, we should say, 24th and K is not right around the corner from where the dorm painting was going on, but it's in the same general vicinity, several blocks away, which seemed puzzling to us. Could it just be a coincidence? Remember, prosecutors suggested Darren parked his van at 24th and K and typed that intersection into his phone on May 14th. But why would he pick that area to park his van? Prosecutors never advanced a theory for that. It was part of the case against Darren Wint that even they acknowledged didn't make a whole lot of sense. It didn't make sense, Judy Pipe argued, because Darren wasn't the person who parked it there. It was Stefan. Prosecutors dismissed the defense's claims out of hand. Stefan was a witness at a murder trial. He was not the man on trial. In a way, we got the sense prosecutors didn't think Darren's lawyers were playing fair. They were throwing people under suspicion without a lot of evidence to back it up. Yes, Judy Pipe had a duty to present a vigorous defense of her client. But if her argument was that the government's case against Darren Wint was too weak, too full of gaps, then what did that make her case against Darren's two brothers? Still, prosecutors seemed compelled to do something to rebut the allegations against Stefan. Laura Bach called the head of human resources for PCM to the stand. That woman testified that supervisors did review employee timesheets, and if anything looked off, they would verify them using GPS systems in company vehicles. But the PCM manager told prosecutors the company only kept GPS records for 2 years before they were deleted. By the time Darren's lawyers sought to pin the blame on Stefan, more than 3 years had gone by. Then it got even more personal. Laura Bach told the jury, "It's not surprising Darren would throw Stefan under the bus. He'd done it before." She referenced an incident back in March of 2015, 2 months before Darren was arrested for the murders on Woodland Drive. Early in the morning on March 23rd, 2015, police stopped Darren when he was driving his minivan into D.C. Darren was unemployed, and he told them he was driving into the city looking for day laborer work. It was a fairly routine traffic stop. Darren's van had bad tags. It was unregistered. But Darren didn't have a valid driver's license either, so he couldn't legally drive. When the police asked him for his name, Darren didn't hesitate. He gave a different name and a different date of birth. Darren said he was Stefan. In the early spring of 2015, before Darren moved in with his dad and his stepmom, he was living with Stefan in an apartment complex in New Carrollton, Maryland. It's just on the other side of Annapolis Road from LaFontaine Blue. At the time, Darren and Stefan's mother, Cheryl, was also living there, as well as their younger half-sister. It's a big family. Before living with Stefan, Darren had been living with their sister, Samantha, in her apartment nearby, but she made him leave after a bad argument. For all the tensions he had with them, Darren's family was seemingly supportive of him and wanted him to get back on his feet. For one thing, Darren stayed at Stefan's rent-free. And remember, Stefan was the one who gave Darren a cell phone. Darren's sisters, back in Guyana, were also sending him money every once in a while, when they could. Despite that, Darren seemed to have trouble getting along with his family members, with the people who cared about him, who took care of him and helped him. About a week after Darren was stopped by police and he gave Stefan's name, there was a fight between Darren and his younger half-sister over doing the dishes, of all things. There was shouting. Stefan said Darren pushed his younger sister, and he told Darren he had to leave. Not just that night to blow off some steam. He had to move out. Darren was enraged. Afterward, Darren left a voicemail for his girlfriend Vanessa on Facebook Messenger, telling her about the situation. You've never heard Darren's voice before. In the last two episodes, we had one of our colleagues read his testimony from the trial. But in this message we're about to play for you, you'll hear Darren's real voice for the first and likely the only time in this podcast. In it, Darren is telling Vanessa about being kicked out of Stefan's, and he mentions his mom, Cheryl.
Just so you know, Cheryl them just put me out and called the police. But this ain't over yet, because I always say this, I did too much for these fucking people. And if I gotta go, they're gonna go with me too. So, I'm sorry. Bye.
You can hear how angry Darren sounds. And more than that, aggrieved. We thought that voicemail was a revealing portrait into how Darren felt toward his family, and especially Stefan, in the spring of 2015. But it turned out there was even more to that voice message. There was another part that the judge ruled was too incendiary for jurors to hear. The attorneys discussed that part of the tape when the jury was outside the courtroom, but they didn't play it. We wondered at the time, what was in it? What was so inflammatory about Darren's message that the judge wouldn't allow it to be played? After the trial ended, we requested a copy of the full audio file from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they handed it over.
Just so you know, Cheradam just put me out and called the police. But this ain't over yet.
That's the part we played already. But here's the part no one heard until the sentencing.
So this might be the last time you talk to me. Because when I leave here, and I go back in the house, I'm going to kill each and every fucking last one of them. I'm going to shoot each and every last one of them in the fucking head. Because I always say this, I did too much for these fucking people. And if I got to go, they're going to go with me too. So, I'm sorry. Bye.
Laura Bach called attention to Darren's rage in that voice message. Many of us have been angry, maybe even left an angry voicemail. But even at your most enraged, would you talk about shooting and killing your brother, your sister, your mom? Laura Bach said that voice message speaks for itself. Prosecutors called Stefan Wendt to testify early on in the trial. But as the weeks ticked on, we still hadn't heard from Darrell. Then the prosecution rested its case. Then the defense rested its case. And still no Darrell. We couldn't figure out why prosecutors didn't have Darrell account for his alibi over the 22 hours the victims were held, the same way they'd done for Stefan. Darren's attorneys were pointing the finger at both brothers. And after prosecutors didn't call Darrell, why didn't the defense? Since they were the ones saying he was the real murderer. After Darren's explosive and exhausting 2 days on the stand, it was time for what's known as the rebuttal phase of the trial, when the prosecution is given one more chance to respond to the defense's case. Before they present their cases, Both sides typically have to reveal their witness list, so there aren't usually many surprises. But in the rebuttal phase, prosecutors can call new witnesses unannounced.
It's the only NFL division where every single team has won the Super Bowl.
Yes, indeed.
Toward the end of the trial, the strategy of the defense and prosecution was consuming our thoughts. Full disclosure, Jack and I were at a local trivia night with our content advisor, Julia Ziegler, enjoying some burgers, when I thought it might be smart to record our conversation about Darrell on my phone. Shout out to Nanny O'Brien's Pub.
It's just, we've been talking about this guy for 3 weeks. I've been talking about this guy for 3 years. And we are coming to the last day when we possibly could hear from him, and I don't think we're going to hear from him. It's very upsetting.
But why didn't the defense call Darrell? All this time we've been thinking, why didn't the prosecution, are they going to call him in rebuttal?
Right.
But the defense is saying this person is the real murderer.
Yeah.
So wouldn't you call that person? Right. Get him on the stand? Where were you on May 13th and 14th?
We were baffled that we hadn't heard from Darrell.
Right, and so the question becomes, why not? Either what does the prosecution have on him, or what does the defense not want someone to hear? Why would you not put him on the stand? I guess we'll see. Do you want your pickle?
The next morning, before closing arguments were set to begin, Laura Bach called Darrell Wynn to the stand. Darrell was wearing a gray hoodie and camouflage pants. We watched him lumber up from the back of the courtroom, walking heavy. He had a pair of construction gloves tucked in his back pocket. It looked like he just came from work. On the stand, Darrell tucked his tall frame into the witness box and sat slightly hunched forward. He looked tired, but he answered every question. Laura Bach began her questioning with his background. Darrell said he didn't grow up with Darren and Stefan and his other half-siblings from Guyana. They all have the same dad, but Darrell was born in Montgomery County, Maryland, after his dad had immigrated to the United States. When Darren and his other siblings came from Guyana in 2000, Darrell was about 14 or 15 years old. He'd grown up as an only child, and Darrell said he embraced his new family. Darren was the big brother he never had. Flash forward to 2015. Darrell was 29 years old. He was still living in Montgomery County. He had a girlfriend and several kids. He said he had a good relationship with Darren at that time. He didn't see Darren that often, or Stefan, or his other half-sister Samantha. But when they all got together, he said, it was love. When Darrell was on the stand, both prosecutors and Darren's defense team spent a lot of time on where he was on May 13th and 14th of 2015. When the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were taken hostage, held for 22 hours, and then killed. Under oath, Darrell stated plainly, that week didn't really stand out to him. He said he couldn't really remember exactly where he was on those days 3 years earlier. Judy Pipe, Darren's lawyer, pounced. Her goal was to raise suspicion about Darrell, just as she'd tried to do with Stefan. She didn't have to prove that Darrell really committed the murders. She just had to make Darrell look suspicious enough that the jurors might doubt Darren's guilt. And it seemed like Darrell's fuzzy memory might be a liability. But expecting that exact reaction from the defense, prosecutors had already dug up evidence that cleared Darrell, most of it digital evidence. Unlike Darren, Darrell had a cell phone plan, and he used his phone a lot over May 13th and 14th. Prosecutors were all too happy to submit into evidence the cell tower pings from Darrell's phone that show he was nowhere near Woodland Drive during those 22 hours. It seemed like every time Judy Pipe tried to pin something on Darrell, Laura Bach had a piece of evidence that supported his testimony. Here's Darrell's alibi. On May 13th, the day the victims were taken hostage, Darrell has a very different account from what Darren says happened. That morning, Darrell said he never met up with Darren to borrow his minivan, like Darren said, nor did he drop him off at Ed's house. But he was near the spot where Darren said he met Darrell. At 6:04 a.m., Darrell's phone pinged off a cell tower near Stefan's work in Beltsville, Maryland. But, Durrell said, he wasn't at PCM to meet Darren. He was there for a legitimate job. He decided to take Stefan up on his offer to do some dorm painting at George Washington University, make some money. And because it was an on-the-books job, his brother made him come in to fill out an application and do an official interview. Later that day, he couldn't remember exactly the time, Durrell said he went to a friend's house in Gaithersburg, a D.C. suburb in Montgomery County, Maryland. He made a point of going to his friend Anthony's house because it was a big day. Anthony had produced a music video for a group of local rappers and musicians. Durrell's cousin was part of the group. The video had just been released that morning. Durrell said he went to Anthony's house to watch it. And at 10:24 a.m., where is Durrell's phone? Exactly where he said it was, pinging off a cell tower near Anthony's house. Since May 13th, 2015 was a Wednesday, Durrell testified he probably would have gone to pick up his son from school that afternoon. Usually after school, they go to the library or to play basketball at the rec center. Sure enough, at 2:44 p.m., Durrell's phone is recorded pinging near a middle school in Tacoma Park. During the trial, there was no mention of surveillance video from the rec center or from the library. But that timestamp is important, 2:44 p.m. Remember, prosecutors believe the intruder slipped into the house on Woodland Drive sometime before 3:30 p.m. For the entire rest of that day, on May 13th, Durrell's phone is only pinging off cell towers in Tacoma Park. What about that night? Durrell didn't offer much initially. His memory was fuzzy. Prosecutor Laura Bach seemed a little vexed. She kind of teed up his answer, asking him if he spent a lot of time at bars in the Silver Spring area back in 2015. Durrell said he did, and he could have been out that night. Then Laura Bach asked if he ever stayed out really late at those bars in Silver Spring. Maybe drank in the parking lot after they were closed. Durrell said he did. Again, Laura Bach pulled his cell phone records, showing Durrell's phone pinging near the parking lot of a Silver Spring bar in the early morning hours of May 14th. Okay, that accounts for the day the victims were held hostage on Woodland Drive. When they ordered the pizzas, were calling the security company, and getting a plan together to withdraw the money. But what about May 14th, the day of the fire? Again, Durrell said he didn't remember. But since he wasn't working regularly, he was responsible for taking care of his younger kids during the day, while his girlfriend worked as a hairstylist. His friend Garnett also had a young daughter, so often the two dads would hang out and watch the kids together. On the afternoon of May 14th, the day the Savopoulos house went up in flames, where was Durrell's cell phone? Pinging in the Silver Spring neighborhood where Garnett lived. And cell phone pings weren't the only thing that put Durrell at Garnett's house. Oddly enough, it has to do with a pizza. Laura Bach entered something into evidence. The big screen in the courtroom lit up. On it, a Domino's pizza receipt appeared. She then asked Durrell, did you ever order pizza when you were at Garnett's house? Durrell said he did, all the time. The receipt is stamped 12:16 p.m., around the time the Australian embassy workers saw a man matching Darren Wint's description slipping into the garage of the Savopoulos house. Remember, in Darren's version of events, Durrell was waiting for him inside the garage. But this pizza receipt showed the jury that around noon on May 14th, Durrell Wint was having lunch delivered to Garnett's house, a large pepperoni pizza with extra sausage and an 8-piece order of breadsticks. Later on, the evening of May 14th, after the fire on Woodland Drive, after the Porsche had been set on fire, Durrell said he did meet up with Darren. That matches with Darren's story. Durrell testified that Darren had been calling his phone all day, first from a number Durrell didn't recognize, likely the tow truck driver's phone, and then from their dad's home phone. Durrell said he drove to his dad's house to meet up with Darren. He said when he got there, they were just talking, hanging out. Durrell said he didn't see his big brother that much, so every time they met up, he said it felt like reuniting. Durrell testified that he told Darren he had to stop by Walmart to pick up some painting clothes and other supplies for the dorm painting job Stefan had hired him for at George Washington University. The orientation and training were the next morning. Darren decided to come along for the ride. But, Durrell said, Darren also asked him to make a stop of his own. He said his van had run out of gas on the road, and he needed to stop and pick some up to get it running again. Durrell said they stopped at a gas station, and Darren filled up a large bucket from the pump. Then they drove to Walmart. During the trial, prosecutors pulled up the Walmart surveillance video and played it for the jury. The first shot is of the parking lot. The timestamp reads 10:23 p.m. You can see a dark-colored sedan pull into a parking space, and two people get out. The next shot shows Darren and Durrell walking into the store. In the video, Durrell is wearing a dark jacket and light-colored jeans. He's taller than Darren. Next to him, Darren is wearing gray sweatpants and a white hoodie with a red stripe down the arms. Now, remember, in Darren's version of the story, the Walmart trip supposedly comes after a very tumultuous day with his brother. He said Durrell drove him to Woodland Drive, tried to get him to steal from it. Then they had a big fight about it. Durrell refused to take him to his van and left him in a parking lot. And then, later that evening, Darren saw on the news that same fancy house where they'd been arguing and eating pizza had gone up in flames and four people were killed. In Darren's story, the two did go to Walmart, but after a day like the one he described in court, you might expect things to be a little tense between the brothers. The Walmart surveillance video is fairly clear. Darren is smiling, casually chatting with his brother as they walk in. Laura Bach pointed to Darren in the video and asked the jury, "Does this look like a man who has the wool pulled over his eyes by his brother?" The running timestamp on the video shows the men spent about 20 minutes in the store. At 10:43 p.m., the brothers are checking out. Durrell puts gloves, painter's pants, a belt, and socks on the counter. He pays with a debit card. Darren doesn't buy anything. Then the surveillance camera tracks the brothers walking out of the store and back to the car. Now, here's where the two brothers' stories differ. Darren said after the Walmart stop, Durrell drove him to a house in Cheverly, Maryland, about 15 minutes away from the Walmart. Durrell went in, and Darren stayed in the car. Darren testified he didn't know whose house it was. But Durrell tells a different story. He says after they left the Walmart, Darren started giving him directions. The bucket of gas was still in the back seat, and Durrell said he thought they were going to put gas in Darren's broken-down van. Durrell said he started to recognize the area. There were a lot of warehouses. There's a school bus lot nearby. And it was near where Darren used to work, at a metalworking plant called Metal Fab. We wanted you to hear part of Durrell's testimony in his own words. We tried to reach Durrell, but since we couldn't get in touch with him, we had our colleague Jamal Bowens read his testimony. Lauren Larson is again reading Laura Bach's part.
Now, what happened when you got to wherever it was Mr. Wendt told you to go?
We pulled over on a, like, about a, like a warehouse back there. We pulled over. He got out the car. He got out the car for like 5 minutes. And when he came back, and we left.
All right. Did you see his van?
No.
You didn't see it anywhere around there?
No.
Was it lit or dark back there?
It was dark.
Okay. Now, are you still sitting in the driver's seat?
Yes.
When Darren Wendt got out of the car, were you watching exactly where he went to?
No.
I mean, honestly, did you really care where the van was?
No.
Durrell said he wasn't sure, but he thought Darren took a bag with him. Maybe a plastic bag? He didn't know. Darren didn't drive away in his van after supposedly putting gas in it. And when he got back in the car, Durrell said he couldn't really remember if Darren still had the bag with him. He was distracted. He felt like something was off. Then, as they drove out of the industrial park, Durrell said he saw smoke from the direction where Darren had walked when he left the car.
All right. Did you say anything to him like, "Hey, buddy, there's some smoke back there"?
No.
All right. What's going through your mind right then?
I just know something looks suspect.
Well, did you say what's going on?
No.
Why not?
I don't ask too much questions.
Well, why not?
I don't like to know people's business.
Why don't you want to know people's business?
Because it's none of my business.
Well, do you want to be sitting in a place like this?
No. Lesson learned.
After they left the industrial park, Durrell said they decided to go back to Walmart. A second trip? Well, Durrell said he'd forgotten a few items he needed for the painter's training. Cue the video. Laura Bach hit play for the jury, and the Walmart surveillance video showed the brothers, again, walking through the Walmart doors. Now the timestamp reads 11:26 p.m. At checkout, Durrell puts a backpack and a water bottle on the counter. And again, he plays with a debit card. But this time, Darren buys something. A black and pink drawstring backpack. In the surveillance video, you can see something else. When he opens his wallet, it looks like it's stuffed with cash. Durrell told Laura Bach that after they left Walmart for the second time, he dropped Darren off at their dad's house, and they made plans to link up again the next day, Friday. According to the cell phone records, the next morning, Darren repeatedly tried calling Durrell. He called more than 24 times on Friday. Durrell testified he remembered that. He also remembered intentionally ignoring those calls. He said he didn't like the vibe he caught the night before. On Friday night, Darren asked Godfrey, his sister's boyfriend, to help him burn his van. An hour after they talked, in the same area where Darren had walked off from Durrell's car the night before, with the bucket and the plastic bag, Darren's blue minivan went up in flames. Now it was Judy Pipe's turn to cross-examine Durrell, and she had clearly come prepared. But she did have a difficult job ahead of her. The government had all these phone records and the pizza receipt to account for Durrell's whereabouts over the 22 hours the victims were held and then killed. They didn't have an account for every move he made. But again, Durrell wasn't on trial for murder. Still, Judy Pipe used what she had. Julia Ziegler is again reading Judy Pipe's part, and Jamal Bowens is continuing Durrell's testimony.
So as you sit here today, what's your memory about what happened on May 13th? Did you go home that night, or were you out at a bar?
Can't remember.
So moving forward to May 14th, I guess as you sit here today, you don't remember where you were on May 14th, right?
No. I just know I was, like, 9 times out of 10, I was in Montgomery County somewhere.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons you're saying you were in Montgomery County is partly that receipt that Miss Bach put up there from Domino's Pizza, right? You saw that receipt?
Yeah, I seen that.
And there's a receipt from Domino's Pizza on May 14th of 2015 around 12:15 p.m., right?
Yeah.
And I think Miss Bach put in there were a few receipts from Domino's. That's somewhere you order from pretty often, right?
Yes.
That's a phone number you know off the top of your head?
Yes.
I guess you would agree with me that having your cell phone GPS alibi you during the times of this crime would be a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You would agree with me that having a credit card receipt that alibis you somewhere else would be a good thing, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And according to you, you keep your phone with you on May 13th and May 14th, right?
Just in general? Yeah, I do.
If anyone's making phone calls from that phone, you say that's you, right?
Yes.
You didn't pass off your phone to anyone?
No.
So when everybody's asking you all these questions about where were you on May 14th, you didn't scroll through your phone to see who you were calling that day?
No.
You didn't notice there was a phone call from Domino's on May 14th at 12:15?
No.
You didn't notice that? Because you never once told the government that you were at Garnett's house ordering pizza around the time that this house went up in flames, right?
Nope. I don't think so.
You never told the police that either, right?
Uh-uh.
Because you weren't with your phone on May 14th, were you, sir?
I was.
Did you have Garnett Williams cover for you for the police in relation to this case?
I didn't need him to or ask him to.
Basically, she argued, Durrell was not a novice. He knew his phone could be tracked. To account for all Durrell's cell phone pings, Judy Pipe theorized Durrell could have easily handed off his phone to a friend, maybe to Garnett. It sounds devious, like the work of a criminal mastermind. And basically, that's how Judy Pipe wanted the jury to think of Durrell. Now, Durrell does have a criminal record, but nothing in it supported her theory. The one thing Judy Pipe could find was a first-degree assault conviction back in 2007. Other than that offense 11 years earlier, Durrell's criminal record included convictions for possession of marijuana and possession with intent to distribute. It seemed misplaced that we and the jury would end up hearing far more about Durrell's criminal record than we'd ever hear about Darren's. We knew from searching online court records that Darren also had a criminal record, which included far more incidents of violence, threats, and assault than his brother. We'll revisit those in a later episode. But none of that was brought before the jury. None of it came into play during the trial. And that's not really surprising. Our justice system is supposed to do just that, protect someone's right to a fair trial by making sure that their innocence or guilt isn't determined by their past actions, but only by the facts of the case. Judy Pipe fired a barrage of sharp questions at Durrell. She made sure to mention that he didn't have an immunity deal with prosecutors, seeming to suggest he could still be charged with something.
You don't have any protection from the government for getting prosecuted in this case, right?
No.
Nobody's promised you that they're not going to charge you with everything that Darren Wint's been charged with, right?
No.
Nobody's promised you that you're not going to go to prison for what happened in that house on May 13th and 14th, right?
No.
And you know that anything you say right now, here on this stand, can be used to put you in prison for those crimes, right?
Yes.
You came here with a lawyer today, right?
Yes.
And you've had a lawyer representing you pretty much throughout this case?
Yes.
As you sit here today, you don't want to be sitting in the seat that Darren Wint's sitting in, do you?
No.
How tall are you, Mr. Wint?
6'2".
Back in May of 2015, about the same height?
Yeah.
How much do you weigh about?
I weigh 240 now.
About the same in May of 2015?
No, I was probably like maybe 200.
Okay, you're a little bit bigger now than you were then?
Yeah.
Are you working these days?
Yes.
What kind of work are you doing?
Construction.
When you showed up here to court today, were you wearing a construction vest?
Yeah.
Right now, in your back pocket, do you have a pair of work gloves?
Yeah.
Judy Pipe was trying to draw any connection she could, but Durrell took it in stride. His demeanor led on he didn't want to be there, but he came across convincing in his answers. Then, Laura Bach tied up any loose ends the jury might still have about Durrell's involvement.
You were asked a bunch of questions about immunity. Did you ever ask anybody for some sort of immunity?
No.
Did you ever go into anybody's house and set it on fire here?
No.
Did you kill anybody?
No.
Did you burn any cars?
No.
Do you know, I mean, what would you need immunity for?
I didn't ask for it.
Do you want to be in here testifying against your brother?
No, I don't.
Okay, what does it feel like to be sitting here testifying against your brother?
This is disappointing.
What do you mean it's disappointing?
It's disappointing. It's just, you know, that's my big brother. And look what you're doing. It's like he should be ashamed of himself for what he's doing. For real.
Laura Bach called other witnesses as part of her effort to show the jury Durrell was not taking victims hostage on Woodland Drive on May 13th. One of them was Anthony Anderson, Durrell's friend whom he visited that day to celebrate the release of the music video. When Anthony took the stand, he testified, yes, Durrell had stopped by that day, and they had watched the video. That day stuck out in his memory, of course, because May 13th was the day the music video officially dropped. The music video was for a song called Haters Hate. In the courtroom, the prosecutors pulled up a screenshot of the YouTube page for the music video. And sure enough, it was uploaded on May 13th, 2015. Now, Haters Hate wasn't a huge hit. It didn't go viral or anything. The video has a couple thousand views on YouTube. But you've heard it before. Haters Hate is the theme music for this podcast. Watch them haters hate. They get mad. I'm so glad to them. Every time I hit the streets, I bet the freaks cooperate. Yes, yes, you know they call me Mr. Moore. I do not gossip play. I see how I cry. I give that just the way I operate. We chose this song as our theme not only because it's catchy. We picked it because it seemed to symbolize our experience covering the twists and turns of this trial. because it was one of those little details that didn't seem to matter in the moment. But later it took on new significance. When Haters Hate dropped in May of 2015, it was just a music video that Darrell's friends had put together that he happened to watch the day it was released. 3 years later, as he was being accused of a horrible crime, testifying at the end of his brother's murder trial, that video had become a key piece of evidence, giving Darrell Wint a solid alibi. When Darrell was on the stand, both the defense and the prosecution had more questions than just about where he was on May 13th and 14th. They asked about his role in Darren's arrest. It's where this episode started and where it will end. You already know that Darrell was with Darren when U.S. Marshals surrounded their caravan. Here's what happened. May 21st, 2015 was a Thursday. It was exactly 1 week since the fire on Woodland Drive, and Darren had officially been named a suspect. Darrell had seen Darren's picture all over the news the night before. He told Laura Buck, people were blowing up his phone all day, asking him if he knew where his brother was. Darrell spent the day in downtown D.C., painting the dorms at George Washington University, doing the job Stefan got him. While he was painting, Darrell said he got a call from Darren, and he answered it. At this point, Darren was still in New York. After he and Vanessa saw his face flash on the news, they fled her Brooklyn apartment to a hotel room, barely escaping the police. Darrell said it was at this point he told Darren he needed to come home and turn himself in. Darrell said he knew Darren was in a bad spot. He was wanted by the police. His face was all over the news. And Darrell said he was concerned for Darren's safety. He was afraid his brother would get hurt, maybe by the police. By the end of the phone call, Darren agreed he'd come back to D.C. to turn himself in. But first, he wanted to meet up with Darrell. He needed help getting a lawyer. Back in New York, Darren paid an off-the-books livery cab driver $1,100 using $100 bills to drive him back to the nation's capital. By the time Darren got to D.C., it was around lunchtime. Darrell told Darren to meet him at 19th and F Streets in downtown D.C., near the dorms where he was working at George Washington University, but not too close. When they met up during his lunch break, Darrell said he and Darren came up with a plan to get Darren a lawyer. They were going to do it before he turned himself in. Darren told Darrell he'd already been in contact with a lawyer, a guy who called himself Lonnie the Street Lawyer, and had regular segments on TV and radio shows. But the problem was paying him. Darrell said that Darren had a lot of cash with him, but the lawyer told Darren he wanted to be paid in money orders. Darrell said he wasn't sure how much the lawyer wanted, but he thought his brother mentioned $10,000. When they went to get a money order, Darrell said they quickly realized they had a problem. Most places cap the limit on a money order at $1,000. They'd have to go to several places to get enough money orders. But Darrell's lunch break was almost up, and he had to get back to work. And Darren couldn't very well just hang out and wait. So Darrell said he decided to get his brother a hotel room. He knew he'd be late getting back to work, but that way, after Darrell's shift ended, they could drive around, get the money orders, get the lawyer, and then Darren could turn himself in. But there was still another problem. Darrell had lost his ID, and he knew he needed one to get a hotel room, so he came up with a quick fix. Darrell drove with Darren over to his friend Garnett's house in Silver Spring so they could use Garnett's ID. The three men then drove to a Howard Johnson motel in College Park, Maryland. It's the kind of place where a room costs less than $100, and the doors to each room face the parking lot. Garnett used his ID and signed for the motel room, but Darrell said Darren paid for it. And when Darrell headed back to finish his shift painting the dorms, an hour and a half later, he said Darren had all that cash with him inside the room. Now, remember, Darrell Wint was called to testify by Laura Bach, the tough federal prosecutor who does not tolerate evasive answers. Darrell was her witness, but she still pushed back on parts of his story. Prosecutors were clear they didn't think Darrell was involved in the murders, but she knew she had to essentially show her work for the jury. She had to ask questions she knew they'd want answers to.
Why do you have to, I don't understand, why do you have to get him a hotel? Why not just take him to the lawyer?
Because with that situation, it's just not that simple.
Well, why isn't it that simple?
Because I don't trust no lawyer, for one. And then two, it's still me and him didn't have like a solid conversation. So I'm not just going to send my brother to the wolves. Like, we sat there and talked first, and then we came to a conclusion.
Okay, when you say you hadn't had a conversation yet, you mean a conversation about what?
Just like what he's going to do. Like, you're going to turn yourself in, or you're going to go about your business.
Okay, did you ever attempt to sit down and have a conversation with your brother about whether or not the stuff that you saw on the news was true?
No.
Okay, well, why not?
Because I didn't want to know.
Why wouldn't you want to know?
Because I just didn't want to know. Yeah.
Darrell said after work he went to the Howard Johnson, and his brother gave him stacks of cash to get more money orders. Now, to get all the money that Darren needed for the lawyer, Darrell would have to make 10 different stops, at least. He needed help. So he called a girl he was friends with, someone he could trust. Chelsea Nunez was several years younger than Darrell, but they both sort of grew up together in the same neighborhood in Tacoma Park, Maryland. When he called, Chelsea was hanging out with one of her friends, Shia. She said she'd help get the money orders, too. Darrell told them all this cash was to get a lawyer for a friend who was turning himself into police. You won't get into any trouble, he said. They met up, piled into Chelsea's white Chevy Cruze, and went out to get as many money orders as they could. Darrell, Chelsea, and Shia drove around Montgomery County, Maryland, hitting up every cash depot, Western Union, and Rite Aid they could find. Chelsea Nunez later testified that Darrell handed them stacks of $100 bills to get those money orders. Getting them all took a long time, and it was starting to get late. Darren was still waiting back at the Howard Johnson, and Darrell said he was starting to feel nervous. All day long, people had been calling him, asking about his brother. They wanted to know if Darrell really knew where his brother was, and was it true? Did his brother really murder those people? Darrell said he felt pressure. That's the word he kept using on the stand. He wanted to help his older brother, but he didn't trust lawyers. He didn't trust the police. And now he felt like he was entangled in the situation. He was in a car with piles of these money orders and thousands of dollars in leftover cash. Darrell collected it all, said goodbye to Chelsea and Shia, and asked to be dropped off at his cousin's place. He said he was looking for a voice of reason. When he testified earlier in the trial, Darrell's cousin, George Elias, said they didn't really have a hanging out type of relationship. But when Darrell showed up at his house in May of 2015, a day after Darren's face was all over the news, George Elias said he had a pretty good idea of what Darrell wanted to talk about. At first, George wouldn't even let his cousin in the house. They talked out front. On the stand, George Elias seemed to have a sort of older and wiser vibe, the kind of all-around peacemaker, problem-solver type who you could turn to with a family issue. Darrell confided in George that he and Darren had a plan, that he'd spent all evening getting money orders, and that they were going to take Darren to get a lawyer and then go to the police. But, Darrell said, he wanted his cousin's guidance. He was getting nervous about all this. George said he'd help Darrell, but he gave him an ultimatum. If you want my help, you have to turn your brother in now. Darrell agreed. George said he'd go with Darrell and turn Darren in, but he didn't want Darren riding with him. He'd be driving his work vehicle, and he didn't want it showing up on the news. It did, though. George worked as an automotive mechanic and drove a big white box truck. So Darrell called the girls back to pick him up. When they returned, Chelsea and Shia had picked up another friend, a woman in her 20s named Felicia. Then they all drove back to meet Darren at the Howard Johnson, the white box truck followed by the Chevy Cruze. When they got to the motel, Darrell was getting ready to go inside when his cousin George stopped him and laid down the law. If you don't come back around that corner with Darren, if you come back by yourself, I'm calling the police right here and now. Darrell went into the room alone. Inside, Durrell said he handed his brother $23,000 in money orders and about $7,000 he still had in cash. Durrell said it was at that point he leveled with his brother. He said they were both feeling the pressure, and they decided to cut out the part of the plan where they get a lawyer. They'd go straight to the police. And afterward, Durrell said, he'd take the money orders and go get a lawyer for his brother. He said Darren agreed. It's a different version of the story than we've heard before. When Darren testified, he didn't mention any agreement. He said when he walked out of the Howard Johnson that night, he thought they were going to meet the lawyer. But what everyone does agree on is what happened next. Darren and Durrell left the motel room. Durrell walked Darren to Chelsea's car, and Darren got in the back seat. Durrell got in the box truck with his cousin George. Felicia Ruffin, the young woman who had been picked up by her girlfriends later, was sitting in the back seat of the Chevy Cruze when a stranger got in next to her. Felicia also testified during Darren's trial. She said she didn't know Darren. She'd never seen him before that night. And remember, she didn't have anything to do with getting the money orders either. Felicia said inside that car, the girls were carrying on as normal. When she was picked up, she thought it was going to be a girls' night. They just had to make a quick stop to give someone a ride as a favor to a friend. In the car, Felicia said the women were talking about boys and trying to goad the guy in the back seat into conversation, but he wasn't interested in small talk. Felicia said he was sort of rude. He shut her down when she tried to make silly conversation. As the trip went on, he seemed to grow more and more agitated. He kept asking, "How long? Where are we going?" During the ride, he was making calls, but he turned down the volume on the phone, so Felicia said she couldn't hear what anyone on the other end was saying. In case you're wondering how Darren was making calls on a phone that only operated off of Wi-Fi, Darren testified at this point he was using a flip phone that Durrell had lent him to call his fiancée, Vanessa. But he was also using it to try and reach Durrell in the box truck. Durrell wasn't picking up. It turns out Durrell was making calls of his own. First, Durrell called his father, Dennis, who's also Darren's father. Durrell said his dad gave him a phone number. He grabbed a pen and scribbled it down on a yellow piece of paper. And he dialed it. Detective Jeff Owens, the lead detective on the case, answered the phone. He gave Durrell an address, 300 Indiana Avenue Northwest. Durrell scrawled that down using a black Sharpie, and next to it he wrote the word jail and underlined it three times. Durrell was turning his brother in. At this point, the box truck was traveling in front of the Chevy Cruze as the two vehicles made their way down Route 1 and into D.C. Shortly before 11 p.m., they crossed the district line, where Route 1 turns into Rhode Island Avenue in northeast D.C. The two vehicles continued on, rolling down a gentle slope past rows of two-story craftsman-style homes and small chain-link fenced lawns, unaware that some 30 law enforcement vehicles were descending on their location. Suddenly, the slow ride came to a screeching halt. The U.S. Marshals moved in, surrounding the box truck and the Chevy Cruze on all sides. An unmarked police car cut between the car and the box truck and reversed, blocking the way. Chelsea slammed on the brakes. She thought there'd been some sort of accident. Then two other cars rammed both sides of her Chevy Cruze. Felicia said the girls screamed. From the back seat, she saw what looked like a billion lights. There were dozens of uniformed police swarming around the car. They had guns drawn and pointing at them. It was like a movie, Felicia said. She looked down and saw bright red laser dots on her chest. The police shouted for them to get out with their hands up and back away from the car. Felicia said she and the girls were terrified. And amid the chaos, Darren just kept repeating, "They're here for me." On the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare.
The jury has reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
We hear from some of the people who decided Darren's fate.
Why did this have to happen? I think that's another one of those questions that we may never know, right? Like, was it entirely about money? Was there a revenge component?
You know, this was a difficult crime for one person to pull off alone.
22 Hours, An American Nightmare, was written, edited, and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks to her, Lauren Larson, and Jamal Bowens for reading the testimony in this episode. If you like our podcast, you can give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps other listeners find 22 Hours. Head to 22HoursPodcast.com to see the Walmart video of Darren and Darrell. That's also where you can leave us any questions or contact us on Twitter at 22HoursPod. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam, Cast of Pods by Doug Maxwell, Beyond the Lows and Incoming Transition by The Whole Other, available in the YouTube audio library. Rhythmic Pulse by Daniel Birch is licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.